Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Hosting with me tonight is Ryder Lee from Raised by Giants. Ryder, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Chris. Thank you. It's an honor and a privilege to be here co-hosting with you. And I think that we're going to have a great conversation here today with Gail.
Oh, yes, we definitely will. And tonight, our guest is Gail Heisen. Before I bring her on, I want to remind you that you can always get new episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and all podcast platforms. Click that link in the description. Check us out on Rockfin. This is where you get all our premium content that you can't find anywhere else. You can get our regular shows and all the amazing premium content from every creator on Rockfin. Also, check out all the awesome new podcasts from the Forbidden Knowledge Network, Inception, Raised by Giants, Day Zero, Dawson Time, and of course, Forbidden Knowledge News and Beyond Classified. You can now get them all in one place. Our website is forbiddenknowledge.news. And finally, guys, you hear me talk about it every show. Go check out C60 Purple Power, maybe the most powerful antioxidant known to man, and the list of things that it's helped me with, it goes on forever. Inflammation, energy, well-being, sleep. And you can get C60 for your pets. Your pets can feel just as great as you. Click the link in the description. You get 10% off your order plus free shipping. Tonight, I want to welcome Gail Heisen. She has had paranormal experiences since she was a teenager. She is known as a telepath, psychic, and remote viewer, and she has contributed to many experiments and papers on paranormal phenomenon. She has also been welcomed into indigenous cultures, and in 2012, she was initiated as a Mongolian Buryat shaman. Did I pronounce that right?
A Buryat?
Buryat. Wow, I was way off.
Right. I think it's 2011, but it's probably a typo.
There we go. Well, thank you so much, Gail. Welcome, and how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. It's hot up here in Northern California. Tomorrow we're going to get some relief, so looking forward to that. And been very busy. I live in an orchard, so I've just been processing pears and apples and grapes. And
oh, sweet.
Making a lot of juice on Friday, so been very busy out there.
Oh, that sounds great. And this is going to be a fun show. Like Ryder said, we're going to discuss your work with shamans, miraculous healings, remote viewing, dreams that might have solved mysteries, and also what it was like to be the test subject for scientific research in the field of metaphysics. But this is your first time on. Of course, we would love to hear how and when this all started for you.
Well, it started when I was very young and used to have experiences. When I'd go to sleep at night, I would find myself traveling around my house and seeing everybody sleeping, including myself. And I didn't realize then, of course, because I was only about 6 years old, that that was called astral travel. And I ended up having that experience way on into my 30s when I started to realize that I could go even further than the house I was living in and go to places with my astral being or whoever it is that you leave your body and go. And I was able to know certain things about family members, about deaths, but I never had any particular training or anything until I took this course called Mind Dynamics that was founded by a man named Alexander Everett. And the class was taught by a man named Werner Erhard, who went on later, years later, to found EST. And, you know, in the 70s, there was a lot of these self-help movements, and there was a million different courses you could take or gurus you could link up to or whatever you wanted to do back then. And this is who I found myself involved with. And the skill that they taught you, which I happened to be able to do before I finished the course, was doing medical diagnosis. And I didn't really know that I could do such a thing until I took this class. And when I took the class, you would learn how to close your eyes and be inside of sort of a workshop in your mind. And in that workshop, you would do healing on people, which as a teenager, I was drawn very much to the idea of being able to do things to help other people. So I would be told the name and the age and the city of someone. And in a matter of, you know, less than a few minutes, I'd be able to tell them all these medical diagnoses, what was wrong with them, what bones were broken, I was doing so many of them that I got to the point I could even tell them some of the drugs that were they were taking for their different illnesses. But I got so involved, I'd spend a week always healing on each person that I'd be working with, that they used me as a, as my friend Russell called me, told me years later, I was a shill. So I would be out there in front of an audience of 100 people or in a living room with 25 people. And I would sit there and somebody in the crowd would present a card of someone they knew that was ill. And then I would, more often than not, tell them pretty accurately what was going wrong with the person's body. And then they would be amazed. And then they'd be told for $150, they could do this also in 2 weekends of training. And so I did that for almost 2 years, volunteer, and till I was about 17. And I was doing a lot of very ill people, like seriously ill, nearly dying kind of people. And I think I had the experience of the energy or some sort of form of the person that was dying. I think he was dying of emphysema. I'm not sure exactly. I don't remember. But whatever it was that was affecting him, he was kind of attaching on to me for life. And when I approached Werner and the organization about what was happening to me and how scary it was, they said, well, it's you create your own reality. So I was kind of blown away that I was sort of this scared person that's having some entity following me. And what was I to do? And my father told me that, who has always been a spiritual man, told me that I needed to face whatever this was and get rid of it and exercise it out of my field. And I was able to successfully do that. And I never had anything to do with Werner or doing those kind of cases or anything like that ever again, because I felt it led me down into this dark place. And I was never taught how to protect yourself, or, you know, now they teach you how to train yourself and protect yourself and have, you know, cover yourself in a cloth or gold light. And then you do this kind of work. But back then they were just sort of oblivious. They were just kind of playing with your minds, you know.
Right. That's very intense. And I want, before we talk about some of your more recent experiences and things that you've done, and before I turn this over to Ryder, I'd just like to know if you could maybe tell us more details about some of the most profound experiences from the earliest experiences you can remember, some of the ones that kind of made you realize that something was different about you.
Well, it was odd, some odd little things. Like, I remember my father had decided to take us all from New York and go live in, I think, one of the first vegan communes from the Vegan Association. And we lived with the president of the vegans in Southern California. And I got exposed to a lot of very interesting characters at a very young age. And a lot of interesting other ideas like yoga and Hindu and Buddhism and eating only raw fruits and vegetables, fasting on water whenever you're sick. We were never sent to a doctor or dentist. So the whole lifestyle of our childhood growing up was very unconventional. Some of the things that would happen is when my dad would bring me to these groups of people that would be talking in different places, later they would say to him, do you realize this is a very spiritual child that you have here? So he was getting these comments from like other people that he would introduce me to. But then I would have older people that sometimes in our neighborhood would just like want me to come and sit by their bed when I was a young child. And somehow that made them feel good to have my energy there. I also would see things in the family, like I was coming sitting on my stoop in the front of my house in Flushing in Queens. And my grandpa Schneider came walking down the stairs on his way to work, perfectly healthy, looking regular and fine. But I just get a complete, they're mostly auditory for me and sometimes a visual combination. But I'm not as visual as I speak with other people who see things in tremendous details. For me, I sort of hear things. And I looked at him and I got this kind of, it almost feels like something whaps you when it comes. And I said, oh my God, grandpa's going to die. And so I didn't say anything to Grandpa, but I called up my father, who was out here in California, and I said, Grandpa, and it's his father, I said, Grandpa's going to die. And he said, how do you know Grandpa's going to die? I said, I don't know. I just saw it. So I didn't have answers to why the things were happening. But when I said it to him, he said, oh, that, how do you know that? And then within 2 weeks of me telling him, he was, you know, in the hospital with a uncurable cancer that, you know, he died in, you know, within a month of, you know, once he was in the hospital, or maybe it was a few weeks, I don't remember. So it'd be things like that. I would dream stuff that would happen before it would happen. Sometimes I would just know, especially when I was doing those remote viewings, well, not remote viewings, those cases we called them, when I was doing a lot of bodies, I would start to see and hear things before they would happen. So before I'd go in my house, all of a sudden the phone would ring. I'd know who was calling before the phone, before I'd have to pick up the phone, and I'd know when what was happening. When I left New York the second time, because we only lived in the commune for a year and returned back to New York, I left at 15 and a half with my first love, you know, that was, we went to Woodstock together, and he lived up a couple of houses up from me, and we were very, very close. And when we left, he was at that time, you know, this is 1970, 71, he was dodging the draft in the Vietnam War. And he had been, you know, you were given numbers then. It was, you know, either 4F and you didn't have to go, or 1A. I think that meant you were going right away to Vietnam as soon as they trained you. So whichever the number was, he got the one that meant he'd be going off to Vietnam right after training. And so he was not wanting to go. And none of the ways to get out at that time were working. It used to be conscientious objector, but too many people were using these things, and he could not get out of being drafted. So we left together running from the FBI, who would be in the neighborhood where we lived, asking what was going, where we were, how they could find him. Whenever they would come to my house, I would dream it in California. So I would wake up and I'd say to Ricky, and my heart would be racing because I didn't want anything to happen to him. And I'd say, oh, I just had a dream last night. These men in suits came to the door and they were going to take you away. And sure enough, I'd get a call that evening from my sister or my grandmother would get on the phone, and she'd say, she only spoke Yiddish. So when the FBI came to the door, she couldn't really give them too many answers that clearly in English. So she would say, "Oi, the ABC was here. The ABC was here." I said, "Oh, you mean the FBI? The FBI?" So it was a nice thing to dream like things like that before they were happening. Had it really been the house I was in, hopefully we would have had enough warning. But I was dreaming what was happening 3,000 miles away. So
how did your astral travel experiences whenever you were a kid, Gail, kind of connect to your remote viewing and your medical diagnosis that you were doing on people? Do you think that there was a connection between whenever you were a kid and having these kind of astral body experiences, and then later on, all of the other spiritual abilities that you were tapping into?
I think that the things as a child, when I would feel like I'd be at the top of the steps and I'd jump all the way down a flight of stairs to the bottom, and there would just be one sort of a leap, these kind of physical sort of feeling, even though I'm back in bed and I'm having this experience, those I thought were really part of my childhood. And I didn't realize till I had done some retreats. I don't know if it was with Ram Dass or Stephen and Andrea Levine. I can't remember which retreats I was attending. And it occurred to me that I could maybe use that same technique I did as a child now as an adult. And so I tried, when I went to bed, I said, well, if I can travel, why can't I travel and see what the city looks like, or what the state looks like, or what the planet looks like? And when I experimented with that, it's not something I do a lot, or it's not my path particularly, or whatever. But I found that I was able to increase my view of astral traveling to be able to be above the earth and really just see the entire planet. And I just pretty much left it at that, wow, this is really a possible way of doing this kind of thing, but it feels different to me than what I do when I remote view or when I get a flash about something in the future. That feels very different than what that astral kind of travel felt like.
Did you ever go past the Earth? Did you ever go into a different realm other than the astral realm? Because as it's explained to me, there are different realms and different layers of our reality. And there's several ones past the astral realm. And the astral realm is actually low on the totem pole still, sort of like our 3D reality. So were you ever able to experience anything past the astral realm or go further than the astral realm?
Well, I'm not sure what the realms are, but I've had these experiences I've come to known as called Kundalini experiences, where in the beginning, when they started happening in my 20s, I didn't know what was happening and it was very frightening. But as I got older and did research and met with different teachers, found out that it was a tremendous amount of energy shooting through my body at that time. And the last time I experienced it was about 4 or 5 years ago. And it seems to happen when I'm in very powerful places and I don't have any control over it, but I've got to a point where at least this last time I had about a 2-minute notice that it was going to start, that it was happening. And I was able to have somebody take me out to a tree. And I held this tree the whole time that I had this Kundalini out-of-body energy experience. And I went to the most amazing, beautiful, like golden temples and places that it's difficult to describe and it doesn't necessarily make any sense, but that's where I was standing, in front of like golden palace temple kind of places. And I've had about, I think about 7 or 8 of those experiences. And the more that I had different information about letting go during the experience when it was happening and not to be afraid and not to feel strange when I hear all kinds of tongue sounds, all kinds of sounds come out when this happens. And I don't know exactly what languages they are or what exactly I'm saying, but there's something very, afterwards, it's a very glowing kind of, my energy level is very high when that's over. My physical body is incredibly exhausted, but the places that I've gone to are very soul-filling, or I don't know what to say. It's hard to describe what it's like when you're just looking at a massive golden place that you don't know where that is, but it feels amazing to be standing in front of.
Yeah, one more question and I'll pass it back to Chris. So you were kind of born into this reality with this kind of remote viewing ability. Is that correct? Am I correct in saying that?
I don't know that I was born into that. I do have my grandmother was somebody who always spoke to the dead and was a very spiritual woman. And I find that it does seem to be, you see that there are other members in the family when you talk to someone, if they do find that some different things they're able to do easily more than other people.
Yeah, it became more natural for you is kind of exactly what I'm saying, because there's some people that they kind of have the ability and then it kind of needs to be trained, right? And then they get involved into these kind of three-letter agency kinds of programs, like, you know, Project Stargate, Project Looking Glass, things like that, that are based in remote viewing and training people how to remote view. So did you go through any, I know it mentioned in your bio, Chris said that you were involved in some kind of programs. Were they three-letter agency programs like that, or were they completely separate?
I did remote viewing for Dean Radin and Russell Targ. And Russell is one of the founders of the Stargate project that ran at Stanford. And I met both of them in 1998. And I had never even heard the word remote viewing when I met them. And they had an office 2 doors down from my husband's office. And they were looking for subjects to be in their experiments. And it was supposed to be people that worked in the company. It was think tank that was founded by Paul Allen, who was one of the richest men in the world at that time. And my husband told them a story about me, and they said, yes, that's the kind of person we're looking for. Can you send her to us? And my first experience with Russell was, he said, sit. I'd like to lay down on the floor when I do this. So we're in my husband's office. Russell sat in the chair. I laid on the floor. He said to me, we want you to draw a picture of a place in the world that will be selected by a computer randomly at 3 o'clock. It's now 1 o'clock. Can you tell us what that computer picture is going to be? And I had no idea that I could do this sort of thing because I'd never been, it wasn't part of the mind dynamics training I'd done as a teenager. And it wasn't something anybody, I'd never even heard the word. And I said, okay, I'll try. You know, I'm always willing to try. And from them, the amount of different experiments I've been in, I learned that I was able to do all these different things I really never knew that I could do. So as Dean said the other day, I interviewed him for my podcast. And he said, you're just a natural, Gail. It's what we call a natural. So I think that would be the best way to answer that is there are things I didn't know I could do until I was asked to do them. And, you know, and any of these things, you're never always 100% correct. It's not like you're a basketball player. You're going to hit the basket every single time. You know, there's times where you don't get the target or you don't find the missing person or you don't know. You know what I'm saying? But in my work together with them, it's been very, very positive, successful work. And I think one of the reasons is because Russell has a way of relaxing the subject and letting them know that they can do this very simple and very easily, and they don't have to have any training. And whenever I do them with him, we always have really wonderful time together. So our relationship continues to this day. I think it was only a few weeks ago he called me up and said, all right, I'm holding something in my hand. Can you tell me what it is? And I tell him what it is. And he says, you're 99.9% correct. He said, so I'm going to mail that thing to you right now.
That's great. Now, I've heard this skill and the training for it kind of described as somewhat like martial arts training, as to where, you know, it's constant evolving and in practice. Do you think that everybody has the ability to do this on a base level? But it's like, you know, those that are better at musical instruments or martial arts or sports or things of that nature, some people may have just a more enhanced ability that they're kind of born with.
Okay, so yes, yes. I think that it's really important for all your listeners out there to know that everyone has the ability to see beyond their present place. Everybody has the ability to have telepathic connection. Everybody has the ability to have dreams if they remember them, to possibly aid them in something they need to know or do. It just has to do with what happens that shuts it down as you're getting older. Because you'll find if you do some of these things with young children who haven't been, I don't want to say brainwashed or whatever, where they end up with a lot of filters, whether it's a tremendous education, religion, whatever the things are, it seems to put like filters here. I worry about me on these shows and these podcasts because I have no filters. So I never know what I'm going to say, you know?
It's okay here.
I have no secrets. So I'm, you know, I share my life openly. I don't know, some of my relatives and family may not be thrilled with the things I may say, but it's, you know, my truths or whatever. And I have this thing about, I feel it's important to share everything and I don't hide any of this. So now Dean explained it to me one day because he wrote to me, he said, yes, you're very psychic. Just go eat a sandwich. And what he explained was that I didn't have the usual filters that a lot of people do, so that when information comes, I don't have my mind coming in the way and saying to me, oh, no, no, that's not in the rule. Or no, you shouldn't think that. Or this is that. And that's not possible. I don't like have those. So it makes it easier for me to access some of these things because I'm more open to it. But I'll tell you, sometimes, and I've seen this a couple of times, but once in my kitchen table, I had a few people over and I had bought this special remote viewing kit that was sold at one of the conferences we went to that had like 150 photos. and you give the people a piece of paper and you tell them, we don't know what's in the envelope. Everyone draw the picture. The most skeptical guy who doesn't believe in dreams, doesn't believe in anything, he drew the most accurate picture of what was in the card. So often, and I think this happens with Russell too, when he's taught all over the world in different countries and different languages, and they get it. You know, it's, so I think it's something that's very simple. It's just that you have to step out of the way. And that's what I feel when I'm doing a remote viewing or I do shamanic work, I have to step out of the way and let the other things come through.
Now, I was hoping you could tell us about your personal experiences with spoon bending and table tipping and things of this nature.
Okay, here. I didn't do a spoon. I did a fork. I don't know if you can see it, but you see it's all.
You can definitely see it. Yeah.
See it? So that's my fork. I'm not a skeptic, but I can't believe the things are true until I see it myself. But I don't say, oh, it's not true. I say, maybe there is spoon bending. I don't know. So when I went to this spoon bending party, it was at an IRVA conference, International Remote Viewing Association conference. And they said, this gentleman who's passed on, Jack Hoke, who was like an amazing guy who threw these spoon bending parties. And you would go in the ballroom of the convention center or wherever the conference was, and down on the floor on a tablecloth, he would have boxes of spoons and forks all laid out. And you would go there and he'd said to everyone, I think there was maybe 100 people. There was a lot of people who came to do this. And he said, just go. And when you feel the spoon or fork that calls you, take that spoon and, you know, sit down in your chair. So I went and I sat down with my spoon, and there was a little old woman behind me, the cutest little lady that was a retired school teacher and looked like, just see your image of the perfect little gray, you know, hair just so, and a petite little woman who's never had any psychic or any information or in anything in this world. She just was coming to see what her student who had grown up had started to do. And he was one of the people that was giving a talk at this conference. So that's why she happened to show up. She's sitting behind me and we have not started this yet. And she's holding her spoon like this and the spoon just bends over in half like that. And now I haven't done one yet. I haven't seen anybody do one yet. I'm still like, does this really work? And I look around and I see she's, I said, have you done this before? She says, no, I don't even know why I'm here. I just came to see my student, you know? So I start yelling for the man, Jack. And I say, Jack, you come and see what this woman just did, you know? So he sees her spoon is bent over and we haven't even started the process yet. And I see that and I realize there's definitely something to spoon bending here, right? And the action was that as a group, you were to focus on your spoon or fork and scream at it, bend, bend, bend. I mean, that was the entire class or whatever teaching of what you were gonna do. And that you had to, you know, really focus your intention. And with all these things, focusing your intention. So I'm doing the spoon, nothing is happening. So I decide, wait a minute, this little old lady did this. How come I can't do this? So I put the spoon back and I look around at the silverware again and I say, oh, a fork that calls me. So I picked up the fork that called me. I went back and I'm holding the fork like this. And well, they can't rub where it was because it's all folded over twice, but I'm just holding the metal and just going like this very gently. And he says, there'll be a point where you feel like it becomes sort of like hot and fluid. And it's almost like I could see tiny molecules inside the spoon all of a sudden. And in that moment, the spoon turned to liquid and I just bent it around and around and I just touched the tongs and they just bent down. So I was blown away because, as I said, I didn't know that I could do this sort of thing or that it would happen. I'm not particularly a bender. You know, like I can't pick up any object and just start bending like this. But there are people, particularly a friend of mine that was at the same conference with us, and she could bend steel. like no matter what you gave her, and she didn't know she could do this. And she went home and she started bending all these things in her house. So I think just like other things, some people have more of a, you know, like we talk about, some people is Michael Jordan and some people just play basketball. She was an amazing bender. So the other day, because I had told this story on some other show, I was talking to my family and everybody, I said to everybody, okay, after we play our mystery trivia game, I'm giving everybody a spoon or fork here. You pick which one you like. And so the other day, we're all screaming, bend, bend, nothing happens. And we look at my husband and his fork has bent over like this. And he's not a skeptic, but he's an MIT Yale scientist guy who's got a scientific brain. And I said, did you go, you know, really hard like this and bend it in half because you're strong or whatever? He said, no, I was just in it. Just I don't have his sample in front of me because he has it in his office. But we're going to have Russell examine it to see if it passes the true bending. You know, there's a certain thing that they can tell when they look at it. Like he, because of this, the way this went around twice, it's like sort of proof somehow that, yes, you really did the function.
Excuse me, my mic was off. That's interesting. Have you done anything since then similar? I know that in your bio that Michelle sent me, they said something about table tipping. What is this?
So the first interview where we're gonna, that you're the first one to ask me about table tipping. So I didn't review my file on it, but I will see as much of it as I can remember in the story, because I found that also very interesting. I saw that table tipping was something that was done starting in 1850s, or I can't remember when. It was when metaphysics and things were really happening big in Europe, and they were using this to see whether they were contacting dead spirits. There was a lot of fake ones that were going on that were using trickery, and I've read about, you know, the different ways they were able to trick the people by, you know, having the table move different ways. But then there were the ones where there was no trickery, and they truly were having an experience with the table. So it was nothing that I particularly ever wanted to do. I just got a phone call from a dear friend, Stanley Krippner, who, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he is the man of dreams. He's 80, I think he's 88 now. And he just finished his last two books he just wrote recently. And he called me up and said, I have a little group that's gathering together, about five people, and we were wondering if you'd like to join us. We want to see if we can do table tipping. And it's this friend of mine's thing. After he saw different things at the last conference, he wants to see whether we can do this. So I said, sure, I don't know anything about table tipping. I'll give it a try, you know? So we go to this, I think he was a retired lawyer, I can't remember, but someone who's well off, and we went to their house and we went in the basement, and they had this big table. I don't mean like a lightweight table. I mean a big table with heavy, big, thick legs. And we didn't know exactly how to do this particularly, so we tried a few different methods. One method was to have music playing, and it had to be sort of happy, uplifting kind of music. And we decided at some point, you know, we kept changing and adding how we did this. At one point, we finally added a candle in the table, on the middle of the table. Another point, we tried it with lights on, lights off, just to see whether any of these things were making the table tipping easier. And it seemed as we kept meeting, we kept building up a stronger connection and energy. And in the beginning, we were having experiences that felt to me almost like a seance, where like individuals or spirits would sort of enter into the room while we were talking to this table, and strange things would happen. Like all the doors and windows are sealed, but we're feeling a breeze going through, or all of a sudden the temperature in the room got very hot. We're like, I'm sweating hot. Then the temperature started to get really cold, where you were like freezing. And we all would be there with our eyes closed. And at first, like, we weren't touching hands. Then we decided that maybe if our hands touched the tips around. And each time that we met, something different would happen. And when we finally had the experience of the table start to move, an excitement went through you, like you just won the prize. I don't know, I can't explain it, but energetically we started laughing and carrying on, and the table responded. And this was a really heavy table. So we were trying to figure out like little techniques of how do we, you know, how could we prove that this was really happening, when two scientists decided to jump into our group. And what's her name? Beverly Rubik and Harry Jabs, I think is his name. He's from England. And that's why if I'd known you were, I could have read up the papers they wrote about this. He started bringing different kinds of equipment that could tell the distance and if it came up. I said, how can we film in the dark? And I was hanging glow sticks on the table so you could see these glow sticks in the dark moving when the table started moving. Well, this table started moving, and three of the people in the group were, I think, over 80 or close to, one woman, maybe she was in her late 70s. The other two men were in their 80s. And there was me and this other, a French woman who was a medium. And then the two scientists joined in, and that was our whole group. The table, by the last few times, because we did this, you know, over every month, we would meet once a month to do this. The table started moving to a point where it was lifting its leg up high and dropping down. And I was getting concerned that somebody's foot was going to get smashed or something was going to happen. Sometimes the table would tip so tippingly this way, and it would be right near Stanley's stomach. And I'd be like, oh my God, you know, we don't want him to get hurt. Well, we decided then to switch to a lighter table that didn't weigh 35 pounds or whatever. And we switched to a table, I think, that weighed 15 pounds or something. I can't remember. And we sat in there, and the activity of energy or whatever it is that's going on with you and the table, each visit became faster and faster. So when we'd meet again, it would start quicker and quicker. And now that we had scientists, they were documenting the time it started, you know, all the different important information for a scientist. And the table started to go around the room. Now, when I'm seeing this table and our hands are like this, because the table's like, you know, going that way. And we got, you know, we're not exactly the youngest group of people in here. And I'm always concerned that I don't want anyone to get hurt. The man who was conducting this was still not happy because he wanted the table to go directly straight up, not where half of it was tilted all the way and the legs were this many inches. So he was never actually satisfied. And I kept saying, but the table's walking around the room, you know, and we can't keep our hands on it. No, I want the table to go straight up. So I thought, you know, and I got to meet these new different people. I love being with Stanley. And each time we have stories about things where it was not possible for the other persons to know this deceased person's information, and yet they would. So I knew things about the persons that had died with one of the, you know, they were present deaths, not like from a long time ago. So the other French medium, she had had two people that had passed while we were doing this. And all of a sudden that person would pop in and I'd say, oh, and I described the person and what was going on. And she'd say, oh my God, yes, that's Michael or whoever, you know. So there was some mixture of the table thing and the spirit connection. And I, you know, we needed more, you know, we like you're asking me, but we were really midway through and then COVID hit. And these are elderly people too. So you have to be extra, extra cautious. So we have not been able to meet since then. So for the last 2 years, you know, we left it at the table walking around with our fingertips, you know, trying to keep on the table together. So I don't know what's next with it.
How, you already kind of touched on it, Gail, but how do we tell the difference between something that's the real thing and the fake? Because there's a lot of illusionists out there, right? Like stage magic has gotten pretty freaking convincing with their act, right? You know, we know people that are, you know, scam artists with the spoon bending tricks and table tipping tricks and certain techniques done with walking on coals and broken glass things. So is there a way, Gail, for a normal person or a spectator to be able to tell a difference between what could be real telekinesis or a real supernatural or paranormal event or what is fake?
Well, you're making me think of two stories, and I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to answer the question exactly. One is, I have done walking on hot coals. So we can speak about that in a minute if you like. And it was not a trick experience. It was very powerful. We have how do I explain this? I was at another conference at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and it was the first time I was shown magic. And it was Daryl Bem from Cornell University. And he goes around debunking and showing you how people can trick you. So here was 70 scientists that he was going to do these couple of demonstrations to show you how you get tricked. And when I was shocked when I found out how tricks are done. So I don't know that I'm the right person. I'm very gullible. I could probably easily be fooled. Here's he's doing this. I'm thinking, oh, yeah. And he said, he holds up the bag like this. And he said, so now, without ever meeting the person in the audience who brought me this bag of things, I'm going to tell you what's in them. Well, it was all a trick. But when he held the bag up, I said, oh, there's a sand dollar in the bag. So when he opens up the bag and he takes out the sand dollar, the people around me had jumped when it happened. And so it brought his attention to me sitting there in the audience. And they said, she said that there was a sand dollar in there before you took it out. And he said, he got off the stage and he said to me, Gail, I just want you to know that what I was doing was magic tricks. He said, but what you just did was real. And I don't really know how to tell you that difference. I just know how it is for me. I mean, if he would have said to me the thing, I would have been fooled. You know, I don't know. I really don't know. But I think the best judge for anyone in any of these things is your gut. What does your gut tell you about that person? Like when Stanley asked me to do spoon bending, Stanley's the most reputable and amazing, one of the most amazing human beings I've met, and I'm honored to call as my friend. I would never not trust him if he said to me, would you like to come and try this? So wherever the source is that's coming from, or whoever connected you to that person, is that somebody you trust? You know, these are the ways, you know, but really it's also your feeling in your body. Like I used to have a lot of shamanic events here, including the walking on hot coals, which we did with a Siberian shaman. And after doing it for a couple of years, I realized I didn't know if I should recommend people anymore, because some of the times later I found out, oh, they weren't such a good person in the end. Or they were really looking to make money and sell their talent or something like this. But I didn't know that till I had a few experiences with them. So after that, I thought to myself, well, I don't think I should recommend anyone because I don't want to steer them to the wrong way. But then it also turns out that sometimes someone can present something to a person, and even though they may not have good ethics about other things they do or whatever they're doing with their things, they actually may open up a door or an awakening in somebody to try something different because of something they said. So who am I to judge whether this shaman or this teacher or this person is the right one for you? You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%. I think it comes down to our intuition. And like you said, our gut, because our gut is where our intuition is. Why do you think that this things like the supernatural and the paranormal and psionic abilities and spoon bending and walking on coals is so hard for people to believe, Gail? Do you think it's because I think you said it before, that they can't explain it, so therefore they brush it off, or maybe that they haven't experienced it and then they just don't believe it, or, you know, it could be because of our mainstream science says it's not possible, right? But again, the reason I think for that is because they can't explain it and make it happen on command, like the gentleman you were saying that wanted it to go straight up and back down, right? Mm-hmm. But they're working with a very flawed and outdated version of science that's been given to them in a nice little neat box that you can't operate outside of. And of course, you can't explain something when you don't have the proper tools to measure it.
You know, my brother-in-law, Peter, who's a great guy, and I love him dearly, and he's known me since I was a little girl. So he's seen me through all these different things, through the medical diagnosis, through the cases, through the dream, all the things, telling each one of my sisters what they're having before they give birth, what the weights would be. I mean, all kinds of stuff he's heard over all these years. And unless I can tell him exactly how much change is in his pocket at that second, there's no way he's ever going to believe anything he's ever heard from me or seen in all these years, because that's his mindset and nothing's going to change it. You know, there's people that I know when Russell and was working with the CIA and the military, it was when the persons themselves came in and did the remote viewing and realized how did that happen, that they were funding money because things were being shown to them that they didn't know how that could be done. So it really depends on the person that's, you know, inquiring what, you know, like some people don't want it to work. They want to prove that you're a phony or a fake or whatever. I'm not interested in that. I just am interested in being me. You know, I'm just me, I'm myself. And I don't make any claims that I'm a this or a that, but I have lots of experiences with paranormal things. And for me, they're very real. But I can't make it that way for another person. You know what I mean? It has to be whatever they feel. And, you know, Dean and I were talking because he's doing some other different research. He does amazing research and experiments. And what he was trying to find for the placebo in an experiment were people who did not ever once in their entire life have anything psychic or unusual happen to them. He said it was nearly impossible to find someone who couldn't once say something had happened in their life. Often it happens around when they've lost a loved one and they experience, like, they see a vision of them, or they hear them, or they feel a sense that they're with them. They have a dream and the person comes and says, make sure to go look in the closet, I left something for you. Things like this happen. And then the persons don't really necessarily want to explore it any further. But if they were asked, did you ever have anything happen? They would have to say yes. And I think that's more common, and obviously is, because Dean said they went through thousands of people to get people who'd never had this.
Right, I agree. And so I want to kind of touch on your shamanic experiences a little bit and get your thoughts on that. And because you spent time with quite a few shamans, and I'm just curious, what does it mean to be a shaman, Gail? Is it something you can become, or is it something you're called to do or born into, you could say?
Well, let's see. I have to give you a quick little story, because this is how it happened for me, the shamanism. I was in New York with Russell Targ, and we were visiting his dear friend and one of the most famous remote viewers ever, Ingo Swan. And when we were visiting with Ingo, after talking about different things and looking at his beautiful paintings and stuff, we got ready to leave. And we went to leave, Ingo looked at me and he said, you know what your problem is? You don't realize that you're a shaman and you don't know how to act like a shaman or be a shaman. I thought that was the strangest thing. And I totally forgot he even said it to me till years later. So then I became part of helping. And then one of the organizers for a conference that had been on for 30 something years by a Berkeley professor, Ruth Inga Hines, and it was called the Shamanism Conference. And she brought shamans from all over the world to one little place in San Rafael. And for a weekend, well, it's about 3 days, you could immerse yourself with shamans from Laos, shamans from Vietnam, shaman from Korea, shaman from Africa. You don't know who would show up to these conferences. So every year I joined her. In fact, this was the time of the year it always was Memorial Weekend. So here she was, or Labor Day, whatever the one we just had. And here she is bringing all these people, running this entire conference. And she says to me, we have Mongolian shamans here right now, and they're supposed to talk at 4 o'clock. The translator didn't arrive, so we expect you to get them ready and make sure, move them into their rooms, get them unpacked, and have them down here by 4 to give their talk. And I looked at her and I said, I don't speak Mongolian. How will I tell them all this? And with her heavy German accent, she said, don't worry, you'll do it. You'll do it. And I went up into this room, and there was this Mongolian shaman, Zorich Batar, who had not, when I opened, I have to open up the suitcase. There were no clothes in there. There was only dead animals, all parts of his tools for his shamanic work. And there was an amazing hat from not a turtle. There was a full bird that he wears on his back. There were foxes. There were all these different things, but there was no clothing, you know. So with charades, I somehow managed to get him to do the presentation. And after that, connected us. And so I invited them at the end of the conference to come with the 6 Mongolians and stay at my house, because I had a guest house, and that I would take them around and show them a little bit of, you know, Northern California. And the next thing I know, I get invited to Mongolia. I go to Mongolia and I'm invited to speak at a conference twice. And the second time I brought my family. And in the second one, when I brought my family in 2011, I met this woman, Zagda, who was a very powerful shaman that liked to do whipping. And the shaman is not for the faint at heart. You know what I mean? You have to be prepared for all kinds of unusual experiences. Otherwise, that, you know, don't even bother going down that path. It has to do with connecting to the spirits of animals, the spirits of the earth, the spirits of nature, and being able to communicate and get information back and forth with this. It has to do with some shamans, like I was initiated as a white Buryat shaman. There are different, I don't know if you want to call them, I don't know what you would actually call it, but there are different types of shamanism in Mongolia that follow different particular paths or rules. So there's the Buryat shaman, and there's many different, I don't know how many other names of the other shamans are. And each one has a different amount of snakes and things. So this is all documented on how to become a shaman when you're a Mongolian shaman person. This is not just woo-woo kind of a thing. There's a whole, you know, regulations on what you do. And when she came here, she was visiting, and then she left. And she came back 2 days later. She was supposed to go to Chicago. And she said, I saw very many spirits around you, and I know that I must initiate you as a shaman. So besides Ingo Swan many years earlier, nobody kept saying to me, oh, you're supposed to be a shaman. And I never said, oh, I want to be a shaman. How do I become a shaman? None of those things occurred. What happened was that I got involved meeting, and every time I would meet these shamans at our conference, I'd be given a gift from them that they wouldn't give to other people. So I had this whole collection of shamanic tools that when she decided I should be initiated as a shaman, I already had a bag ready for, you know, ready to do work with. I then was told we had to do all this preparation. It took us about 6 days. It was very intense. In fact, I can show you a picture here if you'd like to see of what the intensity looks like.
Sure.
In fact, I was initiated September 22nd, 2011. This is a shamanic book I have of all the different things that happened. And, you know, I was in an altered state from all the drumming and chanting and singing that I had to do for hours and hours after a week of not having much sleep doing all this work. And I had to have, you know, my family had to come to watch this. So my kids were here. and my mother was here, and it was a 7-hour ceremony where at one point I was, you know, completely taken off. All my clothes were taken off by them. I didn't know I was going to be naked in front of all these people, but I had to experience the shamanic. Before becoming a shaman, you have to burn off all of the negative energies and things and layers inside your aura or body or whatever field you want to call it. And every culture has a different way of doing it. Some have sweat lodges or, you know, fire things. Some have whipping. And I had told Zagda that from seeing the whipping that we'd had when we were, you know, she whipped me gently, but still was whipping nonetheless. And I didn't know what was going to happen for a shaman, if it was going to be heavy duty whipping. So when I said to her, can we do something else other than whipping? I didn't know that was going to be turned into almost scalding instead. So I had to stand naked over a pot of hot rocks that had been in a fire for 9 hours. And she poured milk and vodka over my head from the top like this to the bottom while I stood over this. And then the hot steam burned all the way up as it came up into my naked body. I think I might have had underwear on, but I'm not sure. There was a woman, fortunately, who wrote up the whole event after she watched it all. So I was able to, you know these different things. But my son said the classic. He said, "Ma, you can't stand heat. It was 95 degrees that day. You were dancing and singing and drumming with all those furs and everything on you." He said, "You could never have done that unless you were in an altered state." So here's a photo of the altered state. I don't know if you can see
it. Oh, yeah.
And that's Zagda, the shaman, you know, after. The nights before when we were making these little things that are hanging from here, those are called the snakes. And you have to give them milk because they are alive and they are bringing you the information from the other worlds to you as you're doing your shamanic work with other people. Well, after we made these tiny little snake tubes, she came down the next morning to measure them, and we were like a centimeter off in different places. We had to redo everything. All the snakes had to be remade. So there's a, you know, and she had a manual. There's a formula of what she's doing, creating this Buryat shamanic, you know, initiation. And it was all done with no translator. So that was a phenomenal telepathic experience. And some filmmakers came up from San Francisco University, and actually we're going to work together again soon to finish this film, since from 10 years ago. That was when I found out. They said to her in Mongolian, "How did she learn how to do what you wanted her to do here?" And she said, "I would just think about what I wanted and Gail would come inside my head and we would talk." So wow. There's something about telepathy that I've had where I've been immersed in other cultures, Japanese, Huichol, Mongolian, where we don't speak the same language, but we tune in just fine. So something about telepathy isn't also understanding a language. It was proved to me by this. She before we were about to start, she said, "Oh, we need this." And she's looking like this. And I come down with a little bag of herbs that had been cut in Siberia. And I was given it in Mongolia and told, "This is a very sacred plant. I don't know if you'll be able to get it back into your country, but try to take it in with you." And I've been given different, you know, types of incense and all the other kinds of different things. But when she was saying, "I need this," I just knew it was this bag that had been given to me a couple of years ago. And I brought it down. And when she looked at it, she just said, "Gail, Gail, Gail."
That's amazing.
So I know there are people who would love to become a shaman or whatever. That was never on my list. I'm just saying that. But truthfully, as I had this experience, I felt like I was finally given my, like, I didn't go to high school, so I don't have a high school diploma. I didn't go to college, but I was given an honorary PhD from the University of Science in Mongolia. And so now I can say, "Oh, well, I have an honorary PhD." This felt like my initiation to like who I was. I mean, it's hard for me to explain, but in that time since she did that, I have different times when I feel the call to like do shamanic things with family or friends that I know. And in this one in July, I did three shamanic, I just call them cleansings or blessings. I don't really know what to say. And I only let them move me by the information I hear of what tool I should use or what I should do. And I just do, I wear my shamanic clothing because I feel real protected. And then I make sound. I make sound with my jaw harp. You've heard the jaw harp, right? With the jaw harp. And this is a very important tool. The jaw harp dates back to Chinggis Khan. So in the museum in Mongolia, there'll be that's how long the jaw harp has been played in that culture. And for some reason, I have a affinity with this jaw harp, and the Mongolians love that. And I play this and I do other different things with the people, never any talking really. And we have some profound experiences, but I always go into it saying, I really don't know if anything's going to happen. We'll just see what occurs. And people in my family and friends have left feeling like they connected to a deceased person or feeling lighter and more relieved, ready to go on with their next day, that they can let go of the loss that they've experienced. Death and me seem to have a very good, like that's one of my, would be more connections. My specialty, yeah, than say spoon bending.
And that is fascinating. Gail, you have led a really interesting life. You've met fascinating people, had amazing experiences. They should make a movie about your life. That would be pretty cool. I thought to close out. Yeah, definitely. I thought to close out today, maybe you could tell us a few of the most profound missing persons cases that you've worked with remote viewing.
Well, first I want to say that I never knew that I could do looking for a missing person. And I've only done it twice because it's a very intense energy when you're going towards like where the missing person might be. It's usually a feeling of, you know, it's a very heavy feeling. And I am a very sensitive person. And so doing that kind of stuff for me is difficult. I don't want to end up taking the persons with me or always feeling that negativity and stuff. So I did not choose to continue doing that kind of work. But I was asked to do one spontaneously by a psychiatrist in Berkeley. And I was asked to do one by a group called the Psy Squad. And the Psy Squad, PSI, they are a group that had been working with the police with a woman named Bev Jaeger, who's now passed on. But she, for 30 years, had helped the police all around the country. But the police department never acknowledges that they've worked with a psychic. And what they do, and they invited me into one of those experiences, is they send out an item or article of that missing person, and they send it to like five different psychics. And they ask that person to give their impressions of what they get from the item. Then that information is given and they review everyone. And when they see the commonness, if five people said it was by a metal building will be sent to the police. So that's how they determine how to set what information. I was the only one who didn't actually get an object in that one, but I was able to come up with information that was also similar to what the other four psychics had said. And it was a very strange, you know, we felt, you know, like there was violence and things with that one. The other one that I did was a missing persons, which was not with a psi organization where they have a whole, you know, formula that they follow to do this. And it was from someone who'd read the book I wrote. I have a manuscript called A Small Medium at Large. And Russell and Dean had told me to write this after they interviewed me. I haven't published it. So if there's any publishers out there, I'm waiting. I had given it to this Berkeley psychiatrist and he read the book. And all he said to me was, I'm going to call you someday. And so 6 months later, I'm in the kitchen washing dishes and the phone rings. I pick it up and he said, yes, I'm not saying any names for their privacy, but he passed away also. And he says, I have a client with me, one of my patients, and their mother is missing. And we were hoping you could find her. I was like, what? You know, I'm doing dishes, right? But sure enough, when the young man got on the phone, I said to him, how do you feel about your mother? And he said, I just was with her, he said, and she sent me some money. And then I tried to call her. And for 8 days, there's been no answer. And that's not my mother. He said she was living here in Berkeley and she moved to Colorado to live with her new boyfriend. And I spent Christmas with her and everything was great. I said, did your mom have cancer? He said, no. I said, did she have some kind of sickness or illnesses or anything that bothered her? He said, no, she jogged, she hiked, she was in great shape. I said, okay, well, I think what you should do is look into your gut and you tell yourself how you feel if your mother is here or gone and you're connected to her because you're her son. I said, can I speak to the psychiatrist again? So the psychiatrist, Abe, gets on the phone and I say to Abe, I don't know what to do. I said, as soon as he got on the phone, I said, I saw her. I said, but I'm not going to tell him I saw her. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I've never done this before. But she was dead in her car, slumped on a steering wheel on the side of the road by a bunch of big boulders, you know, like big rock things. So I said, that's all I can tell you. I said, and I'm not saying that to him because what if I was wrong? I'm not going to give information like that out. So he said, thank you. You've been very helpful. We appreciate it. Calls me back an hour, 2 hours, maybe 3 hours later, and says, nothing to do with necessarily the information you gave us, though we did give it to the Colorado police. They found her. Her car was to the side of the road. She was slumped over the steering wheel, dead, around rocks, like you said. And the police asked me to call you back because they want you to know, want your opinion. Do you think there was foul play and somebody murdered her? And I was there was not a question in my mind that this woman had not been hurt by any other person, because it was not like the other one where I'd looked for the missing person. That was like a violent, scary feeling when you came upon the scene. This was like, no, I said, there was nothing negative here. There was no bad anything. It was not, I don't feel any of those kind of feelings. Next day, he calls me up. When the police went to her house and found all her things exactly where she'd left them, except her car, there was a suicide note left. In Berkeley, they had found out she had been covered in cancer and that the cancer was so far gone, they couldn't treat her or do anything to help her. And that she had a very short time to live and she didn't have a lot of money and she didn't want to put her family in California through all that torture. So she decided to do asphyxiation in the car and she died breathing carbon monoxide poisoning. And when they found the letter, they knew that it was all true. There had been no foul play like they were suspecting. And years later at a conference, I told that story and a woman that was in the group happened to know that family and the child, because the child that had called me was her son's best friend. And I got to hear the whole rest of the story and how whatever information I had was very helpful to them. And then I never wanted to do them anymore after that.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine. Wow, that's pretty insane.
So I hope that sort of answers that question.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
There are wonderful people out there doing that, and I'm glad that they are. And they have very good results and they work with the police departments and many, many things have been recovered and people have been found from their help. So I encourage it. It's just not, you know, the thing that I want to do.
Right. I can see how that can be a bit depressing there. Now, before you head out, you are working on a book, right?
Yeah, I've finished it. I'd love to get it published someday.
Any ideas on when you're expecting it to be out?
I don't know. What I'm doing right now is creating an internet presence that the publishers say you must have before they'll publish your book. So I launched my first podcast on September 1st. I had Sally Rhinefeather, who was the daughter of J.B. Rhine, who coined the word ESP, 91 years old, an amazing, inspirational woman. I have Stephen Schwartz coming up this the 15th. It's Pacific 1 p.m. And if your people go, I guess they'll see it in the description, but yes, it's a small, medium, at large podcast with Gail Heisen. Because there are other small, medium, at large sites up there, you have to have the Gail hyphen and the A at the beginning, and it will get you there.
Awesome. Great. Well, I'll have those links in the description. Ryder, thank you so much for coming on and hosting with us today as well. Amazing job there.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much, Chris, for having me on. And thank you, Gail. Your story is amazing. And I think that you really described what the shamanic experience really is, because the Western version of what they've turned the shamanic experience into is like, you know, a bunch of people going out and getting freaky in the woods and tripping balls or something, you know what I mean? Which, that doesn't sound half bad, you know, some of the time, you know, who doesn't want to go in the woods and trip balls and have a good time sometimes, you know, but that's the Western spin that I think that's been projected onto it. That's there in order to discredit and make these kinds of things look crazy, but that's not what I feel that the shamanic experience is really about. So thank you so much, Gail, for sharing your experiences with everyone, and keep doing your show, keep doing your podcast, and put out your book, because I think that your story is very inspirational and answers a lot of questions about our reality.
Yeah, let's get that get that Gail Hyson movie made, man. That'd be a killer movie.
Right, oh, Gail? No, now we got to do a TV series, bro. Movies are over, dude. We need a Netflix freaking special. Right. We need a mini series now.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on. We had a great time, and I'd love to talk to you again in the future.
Well, if you want me again, just send me a buzz or send me an email, whatever. And if you ever want to, you know, whatever you like to do, I'm happy to talk about.
Sounds great. Well, I'll talk to you again soon. And until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening. We'll talk again tomorrow.